Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome to the courtroom today two high school groups. We have Stockbridge High School students. Would they stand, please? Good. We're delighted to see you. Please be seated. And we have Spotted Eagle High School. Would those students please stand? We're delighted to have you with us also. Please be seated. The students are with the court today as part of a national award-winning program called Court with Class. This program is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. Students all over the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they're sent briefs of the case we're about to hear. And these students may have engaged in activities related to this case. As part of the program, the students meet with a justice after our second oral argument today. And we discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. And everyone is invited to attend that open session with the students. With those introductory remarks made, I'm going to introduce the court. Starting on the far right is Justice Patience Wilkinson. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with the students after the second case. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. We'll now hear our first case for today, 04AP 1991, Thomas G. Butler versus Advanced Drainage Systems. Arguing on behalf of Thomas Butler and others is Matthew Biegert. You may proceed.
Justices, counsel, guests, good morning. My name is Matthew Biegert. I represent the intervening plaintiff group of landowners in this case. With me at counsel table is Tracy Toole, who represents the plaintiff's group of landowners. I'll be arguing for both this morning. I'm not in front of the Supreme Court today asking you to make new law. I'm not asking you to decide a difficult constitutional or statutory construction question. I'm asking you to simply apply the basic laws concerning Wisconsin negligence that have been set forth in any number of cases by this court before. Briefly talking about the facts of this case as they're relevant to that issue, the contractors in this case were hired to design, construct, and provide materials for a water diversion project up on Shell Lake. We haven't talked a lot about negligence in our briefing because it's been conceded for the purposes of summary judgment. But in this case, there was almost a comic level of ineptitude here. The wrong materials were provided or designed for. The materials were defective. They were installed in an improper fashion. The project, which was designed to meet a level of 10.8 PSI in pressure, was failing at pressures of only 3 or 4 PSI. As a result of that failure, the lake level not only failed to diminish, but it actually rose during this period. As a result in this rise in water level, my clients suffered physical damage to their property. As a result, they brought suit against these contractors. Before I talk any more about the facts of the case, I'd like to briefly talk about Wisconsin tort law in general. Wisconsin is a universal duty or Paul's Graf dissent state. The basic formulations for what that means One of them was set forth, I think is easy to understand, by Justice Wilcox in the Gritzner case, where he said the duty of care does not depend on whether the injury to that particular victim was foreseeable. Now, I don't think that should be outcome determinative in this case, whether or not this is a Paul's Graft Descent jurisdiction. I don't think that anyone can claim these injuries to the property owners were not foreseeable, given the information that's available in the record. However, while the outcome may be the same, the analysis is significantly different here. Again, I'd like to look at...
Let me ask you a question, because so you're saying the outcome would be, I believe you say in your brief, the outcome would be the same whether you used the Paul's Graft approach, duty breach cause, or you used 324A. I believe you, if you say either way you're going to win, because I think you would prefer to use the duty breach cause, which you're arguing, but you're saying either way.
I'm saying if this was not a Paul's Graft Descent jurisdiction, if we followed the Cardozo majority analysis, we should still prevail. Correct.
Under the framework set forth in restatement, the 1965, correct?
Correct. If in this case the court were applying the Good Samaritan Doctrine as articulated and codified in Section 324A of the restatement, we should prevail. But if we look at Gritzner, and I want to point to some language in Gritzner. Gritzner was a case where somebody sued. They had dropped their minor daughter off at a neighbor's house. The neighbor's son molested the daughter. They claimed failure to warn. They claimed failure to supervise. And I want to quote some language from this case, starting at paragraph 21. Defendant frames his response to plaintiff's claims under the rules governing affirmative duty to act in the restatement second of torts, which provide in the absence of a special relationship, a person does not have a duty to take affirmative action to help or protect another person. Restatement second of torts, sections 314 to 324. This court has considered and relied upon some of these restatement provisions in evaluating negligence claims. However, this court has not expressly adopted this framework. Instead, the general framework governing the duty of care in Wisconsin negligence actions is that a person is negligent when he or she fails to exercise ordinary care. Ordinary care is the care which a reasonable person would use in same or similar circumstances. A person is not using ordinary care and is negligent if the person, without intending to do harm, does something or fails to do something that a reasonable person would recognize as creating an unreasonable risk of injury or damage to person or property, citing the pattern jury instruction. That is the law in Wisconsin, and I believe the Gritzner opinion in Justice Wilcox was correct when they rejected using the framework of the restatement to attempt to deny liability. They looked instead to the basic principles of Wisconsin law and the jury instruction formulation to determine whether there was negligence. Clearly, in this case, there's a failure to exercise ordinary care. Nobody disputes that.
But you dispute, then, with regard to the framework, paragraph 20 of the Court of Appeals opinion says at the bottom of paragraph 20 and the corresponding footnote, if 324A is the appropriate framework, then that establishes the parameters for the duty to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances. Then there's this footnote, footnote 10. And footnote 10 at the bottom of the page in the slip opinion says, in this case, as in Stevenson, no specific framework for analyzing the defendant's liability other than the restatement 324A was proposed. I guess you would take exception to that. The framework that you are apparently have proposed is the ordinary common law negligence framework that we've used for years. That's what I hear you saying.
That's correct, and I don't know where the Court of Appeals got that or what they meant by it, but we have consistently argued that we don't believe the 324A framework or the Good Samaritan Doctrine should be applied in this case.
What was the damage to your clients here?
Because it's so early in the case, we don't really know. I can tell you in general, damage to many clients was destruction of their beaches, destruction of lawn, destruction of mature trees.
Suppose that this contract had not been entered into, and suppose the drainage pipes had not been put in, would the damage have been the same? I mean, what I'm trying to ask is, I'm assuming that the work of the contractors did not increase the flooding?
In the sense that if the contractors had done absolutely nothing, would the flood levels be any higher?
Yeah.
No.
So the flood levels are the same with the contract, without the contract, and with the contract not being performed. Because, look, if the drainage pipes had increased the flooding, because they backed up the river into the lake, right?
Right.
You wouldn't be here. I mean, it would be conceded that their negligence caused your damage.
It would.
Isn't that right?
I believe so.
Straight tort law.
And I think, though, it is conceded that their negligence caused the damage. If, again, you look at the jury instruction formulation, you not only have a failure, negligent action, but failure to act. If you're talking about your analysis, then a failure to act would almost never be actionable in negligence. If a doctor fails to diagnose cancer, are they in no worse circumstance than if the doctor had done nothing? If somebody fails to clear snow, are they in the same circumstance? No, because presumably somebody else who was competent would have been hired to perform that task.
I'm sorry, Chief. No, here, under the facts of this, and the question is, first of all, you have this relationship between the city and the contractor. The city, as I understand it, sued the contractors and recovered. Am I correct?
I believe they settled and recovered some amount of money.
They settled, yeah. But there was a suit. I assume there was a lawsuit, and then it was settled, and they received some type of settlement. Your clients are constituents, are basically this problem of the lake level has been going on for a long time. But your clients chipped in or were assessed. I shouldn't say that. They didn't chip in. They were asked to spend $650,000, not your clients particularly, but the people around the lake as a special assessment. So they were disappointed from their aspect that they expected there was an expectation that the water level would go down. It did go down eventually when they put the slip pipe in. I assume after reading the facts that that's what happened. But during this period of time, for about 1 year, the level of the lake actually rose about 10 inches.
That's correct.
So what you're basing the damage on is that it was the expectation, and this ties into the chief's question. She said, had you done nothing, the flooding was there before, it didn't work, and the flooding was thereafter. But the expectation you had was that they would have lowered that and would not have risen an additional 10 inches. Is that?
What their reasonable expectation, reasonable reliance was had this project been performed non-negligently, the water level would have not only not risen, but would have actually receded.
So they would not have had to endure another year of rising water.
That is correct.
Okay.
And that's the damage in this case. Now,
Counselor, you know, on a policy basis, if I buy your argument that the city saw this problem, it was harming city residents, they decided to address it. So they hired a contractor, and the contractor didn't do a good job. I think we've agreed on that for at least purposes of summary judgment. Then don't we open up to sue any contractor who undertakes a project for a city that the city undertakes because they think they're going to benefit their citizens? That seems like a whole lot of lawsuits that we haven't had before. Can you address that for me?
And you're absolutely following the correct analysis, is that what we do is we move to public policy reasons for limiting liability rather than look at 324A. And looking at those public policies as set forth in Alvarado and other cases, public policy is not implicated in this case. Let me make two general reasons and then talk specifically. The general reason is that when we look at the cases that have applied public policy to limit liability, cases like Bowen and Stewart talk about them being extreme and unusual cases or cases that shock the conscience of the court to impose liability. I don't think this is such a case. Second, they talk about liability in determining whether public policy should immunize tortfeasors from liability should generally be done on a developed record, usually after trial. We have no idea what the damages are here. We have no idea if ADS, for example, is 0% negligent, 5% negligent, 50% negligent, 100% negligent. So as a general matter, we would argue that it is certainly premature to invoke the public policy analysis. And based on the record, we don't think there's sufficient facts to implicate the public policy analysis. Now, looking at the specific factors, what reason is there to immunize contractors? And what I think the court needs to look at first is you have already given governmental contractors a safe harbor, an immunity, and that's the Lyons versus CNA case that we cite in our brief. In that case, governmental contractors are immune to the same extent the municipality is immune if they follow the safe harbor provisions there. They follow a government directive as to how this project is going to be designed, that if they are aware of aspects of the plan or aspects of the design that may not meet standards, they notify the governmental agency. If in this case, Shell Lake had said, we understand that this is iffy, but, you know, we're really trying to do this on a budget, and we want you to go ahead and do it this way, the contractors would walk for doing that. They would be immune. So the idea that there is a vast amount of liability out there for contractors simply, I don't think, is borne out by the fact that there is a significant case out there granting them immunity when they're working for a governmental agency. Second is that just in terms of some of the things, particularly in the contractor's amicus brief, seem to me to be highly speculative. The law has been this way for a long time. Governmental contractors have not been getting immunity under the Good Samaritan Doctrine as it exists now. There is no crisis that I am aware of in contracting. As far as I know, contractors are still lined up where I am to take money and to build projects. Nobody is not doing that. There also, in this case, is a relatively easy stopping point, direct physical damage to property. Now, again, we've cited some cases, I think the Lead-Free case and the Sussex Tool case, that said, you know, if you had a more tenuous claim, for example, if one of my clients was a real estate agent in Spooner, 7 miles up the road, and she said, while this, you know, I make a lot of my money selling lakefront property, and while this was going on, my commissions really took a hit because I couldn't move that property. In such a case, you would have negligence, you would have causation, you would have damages. This court, though, may well say, based on public policy reasons, we're not willing to go that far. That's another case for another day. But I think in this case, you have a relatively simple item of damage, and it's relatively simple to draw the line.
Counsel, I have one other question for you. Why didn't you plead third-party beneficiary status and a breach of contract claim? You pled negligence, you pled inverse condemnation and nuisance. Why didn't you plead the other claim? Did it have anything to do with the lawsuit that already came down by the city?
It did not have anything to do, and I wish I could explain there was some well-thought-out reason. I suspect that I would be less attractive because of the potential remedies in contract rather than tort, but there was no particular reason that I can advance why the one theory wasn't pled as a result of the, as opposed to another theory. Now, to a certain extent, I don't think that any of the public policy factors are changed by the fact that you say, well, we're not going to allow this pleading to go forward in tort, but we are going to allow this pleading to go forward in contract. The fact is, the issues in this case, whether or not somebody should be liable for the damages that are caused, whether the contractor should be liable, the theory doesn't really make a difference. Either they should be liable as a matter of public policy or they shouldn't be liable as a matter of public policy.
Could you please explain exactly what the status of the city is in this suit now?
The city in this suit. In this suit, the city was dismissed on summary judgment. I believe the city was dismissed for the same reasons as all the other defendants, not specifically because of governmental immunity. We chose, however, in looking at our claims against the city and looking what the evidence had developed during the discovery, not to appeal the city's dismissal, and the city chose to waive any costs. So the city is out of it in this case. It is out of it for good, regardless of the results of this action.
And are the defendants claiming any of that governmental immunity that the city...
They have not pled that to date. They have not raised that in their pleadings to date. I don't know whether they would be foreclosed from raising that if they believed they were entitled to governmental immunity or governmental contractor immunity under Lyons, but they have not claimed that to date. Jumping back a step, we don't dispute that Section 324A has been applied by Wisconsin courts previously. And it's been applied, as noted in Stevenson, as it's been applied, it comports with Wisconsin principles of negligence law. And the reason is because in those cases it's been applied, cases like Miller and Stevenson and American Mutual, it's been applied to establish a common law duty that may not exist or that would not have existed in the absence of the Good Samaritan doctrine. In other words, it has always been used as a basis to establish liability and establish duty that may not have been there previously or absent the Good Samaritan doctrine. It has never been used in the fashion that it is being used by the contractors and by the Court of Appeals, and that is to take a situation where there is liability under the common law, is liability under Wisconsin tort principles, and set up an additional hurdle that must be met in order to show liability. The analysis that was used by the Court of Appeals runs afoul of Wisconsin court principles. Wisconsin tort principles is that once negligence is established, we look at this public policy balancing test that's set forth in Alvarado and Bowen and other cases.
Counselor, if that's correct, and 324A, the initial premise is that there is negligence, and then you can maintain a suit only when one of the three criteria listed are met. Now, if your argument is correct, that it's never been used when there is negligence, I don't see how I can read 324A that way because it starts out saying there's negligence. So you lost me a little bit on that one.
And I'm not sure if I understood the question. Let me explain how I think 324A is applied. You get to a case where, let's take the Stevenson case. And the Stevenson case where somebody at an office party promised to drive the person home, doesn't. Intoxicated person goes out and kills someone. In that case, what 324A is court looked at the general language of what constitutes negligence in Wisconsin, and they found it was consistent to more specifically look at 324A to see whether this action constitutes negligence. And they went and looked at 324A and they said, look, this fits the criteria of 324A, at least for purposes of summary judgment, and therefore liability may be established here. Now, we're dealing with a different type of situation.
Well, in Stevenson, and I don't want to, I have some familiarity with that, it was because there was gratuitous, this was a gratuitous act of the, that this was a private case where there was, and I think the court felt that it fit under, because of the gratuity, because of the volunteer. Now, I think your argument here is, that's different than what we have here, right?
It's very different than the facts of this case, although it's important to note that 324A and the Good Samaritan Doctrine, the language in it, isn't dependent on the act being gratuitous. It specifically says in 324A, it doesn't matter if the contractor's got $1.6 million here. If you're analyzing it under 324A, you're analyzing it under 324A regardless of the payment.
Counsel, I want to return to the question that was touched upon by Justice Rogensack, and that is you made the statement that 324A has never been used to limit liability. I mean, that in our analysis, before we get to the question, in our common law analysis, before we get to the question of whether or not we are going to limit liability, we assume negligence. Isn't that the structure of our analysis? Maybe you don't think so, but I think so.
Presuming an adequate record on summary judgment, correct.
Yeah, you presume negligence, and then you get to the question of limitation of liability, even though there is negligence or may be negligence. So do you...
Do you stand by your assertion that 324A has never been used to limit liability?
I stand by my assertion that the reported cases in Wisconsin have never used 324A to limit liability that would otherwise exist under the common law. Yes. I don't want to, and I don't have time to talk about the various subsections of 324A. Again, I think for reasons set forth in the brief, that if we were required to meet one of those subsections, the record is sufficient that we have met, in fact, all of the subsections under 324A.
Gregor, would you focus on subsection C, please?
Subsection C is the reliance section?
Yes.
I think there are two reasons why we meet reliance under that section. One is it can be reliance by a third party. It can be reliance by the city. The city obviously relied on it. It went out. It hired these people. It signed contracts. It paid them money. It knew there was a problem. It wanted to get somebody to fix the problem.
How many bids were made towards this project?
I don't know how many are in the record. The bidding was broken down in three separate. There was a material bid, there was a labor bid, there was a design bid. I don't think there were multiple design bids. I'm pretty sure there were multiple bids on the other two items. I want to say three or four.
Didn't the city actually reject the slip pipe that was ultimately used to repair the damage later? Wasn't that rejected beforehand?
I believe that it was rejected in the initial proposed design.
I guess my question was, when they rejected that, and I know that at least according to one of the briefs it says it because it was too costly, was that based upon any reliance that the bid that was ultimately accepted would meet all the requirements necessary to meet the pressure issues?
It certainly, presumably, if they had been told that the $1.6 million project wasn't going to work, they would have spent more money, or they would have done something else, or they would have sent it back to the design table. They wouldn't have paid money on a project that wasn't going to work or where there was a high chance of failure. So, yes, they were relying on the engineers and the pipe company saying, you build this, it's going to do what you're asking us to do. And, again, the landowners also specifically, as I think Justice Wilcox noted, ponied up $650,000 in special assessments so that this project could go forward. And again, under the case law we cite, this isn't a case where I'm on vacation, I'm coming back at night, and my neighbor looks at my driveway and says, you know, gee, it would be a nice thing to do to go shovel his driveway so when he gets in late at night, you know, his driveway is clean, and then I slip and I sue him. This isn't a case like that where somebody gratuitously does something, there's no reliance. This is a case where somebody contracted and paid a lot of money for these folks to build something that would work. So there was reliance here. Last point on reliance, as I understand the argument of defendants, if we had one of my clients say, you know, geez, if I had known this wasn't going to work, I would have built a berm or something and protected my house. Liability. If I had another client who's, well, I was down in Florida, I probably wouldn't have done anything if I had known it was going to fail. I would have crossed my fingers and prayed. No liability. In other words, under their analysis, what we have to do is, to determine liability, we have to go around the lake to each individual property owner, and to determine whether a duty is owed, we have to look at whether or not there's reliance. And again, this is inconsistent with the universal duty analysis. Once they take the action, once they act negligently, they owe a duty to everyone. They owe a duty to the universe, and then we look at the public policy factors to see whether any of them are implicated to immunize them from the damages caused by their negligence.
Did the city rely?
Did the city rely on them? Absolutely.
So why do you need reliance by the third parties?
You don't. You don't.
Because that's what the comments say. Comments say, where the reliance of the other, which is the city here, or the third person, has induced him to forego other remedies or precautions, the harm results from the negligence as fully as if the actor had created the risk.
Once the city has relied on them, that is sufficient to establish duty under 324A and establish liability under 324A.
Yeah, but there's a caveat. It says in the caveat, as in the case of harm resulting to the person to whom a promise is made, the ancient distinction between misfeasance and nonfeasance has persisted when the harm results to third persons. You're arguing this is not nonfeasance, but misfeasance.
I don't think the result would necessarily be the same if for some reason they had started this. Started the project 6 months late because they were busy, but it may be a different analysis. In this case, before the court, there is affirmative acts of negligence. There is supplying defective pipe. There is installing it improperly. There is designing the project improperly.
Does the city's settlement of its suit against the contractors in any way affect your cause of action?
I don't believe it does. To the extent that, you know, for example, and I have no reason to believe it's the case, that the city agreed to hold them harmless. There haven't been any such documents entered into the record in this case. There hasn't been any indication from the defendants that their settlement with the city affects this in any matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney David Rice, representing Advanced Drainage Systems.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm David Rice. I'm from Sparta. I represent actually Huffman Construction Company, but I'll be speaking on behalf of all of the defendants. I'm going to give you just a little outline of my presentation so you can tell where I'll be going. Initially, I want to highlight some of the historical facts here that are undisputed. Then I want to review the public policies that are involved in Section 324A, the contract tort distinction, and, of course, the policy of torts. This case is all about public policy.
If you can ask, I want to, before you get into this, and I want to listen to your outline, one of the things that troubles me here is why we're using, you know, we have the plaintiff saying we should just go under Paul's graph, duty breach cause. You're saying, no, this is a 324 situation. Can you just tell me why it is and why you think that we should not use the Paul's graph to center our traditional way?
Well, the general duty, the negligence causation duty or foreseeable harm and ordinary care standard for torts does not automatically lead to liability. There's always public policy that has to be applied and can relieve parties of tort. The court has previously delineated these six traditional policy factors. We believe that 324A is another means by which this court has recognized that there's public policy. In fact, some of the same public policy involved in cases where people are undertaking contracts or volunteer efforts to protect the property of other people.
But why should we use that here?
It should be used in this case. I think to answer your question, if you'll indulge me, I'll give you a little story about what I think is the policy behind Section 324A. When I was an 18-year-old going to school here in Madison, I went home for spring break and picked up a lacrosse paper and saw that the Mississippi River and two other rivers that come in La Crosse were all flooding. And the First Street and Second Street were underwater. And
1965, I practiced in La Crosse then, so I'm
okay. And Third Street was threatened, and they let kids out of school, went down and sandbagged buildings. The city employees went down and sandbagged buildings, and they hired private contractors to sandbag buildings. The policy of Section 324A is, if you want people to undertake these kinds of things to protect the property of other people, you can't tell them that if you make a mistake, you're going to be responsible for damage flood damage that would have happened anyway. And that's the public policy behind Section 324A, and we think that applies here.
Even if they were negligent in putting the sandbags?
Even if they were negligent in putting in the sandbags. It's a...
It would have happened anyway.
That's correct. And it's a method of that I think has been used around the country and by this court of actually judicial line drawing to say when you have a conflict between the policies of contract law, of tort law, and of law relating to efforts to protect other people, you have to balance those three. We think 324A balances those three.
Now, but D says... Even where, this is a comment to 324A, and then let us get to your outline. D says, even where the negligence of the actor does not create any new risk, that's the example you gave, or increase the existing one, he is still subject to liability if by his undertaking with the other, and that would have been to the city of La Crosse in your example, he is undertaking a duty which the other owes to the third person, and that's the city owes. Do you think the city owed a duty to the
property owners? No, I don't.
Okay. So that's why you get out from under that.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. Why don't you give us your outline?
Okay.
You usually get a free 5 minutes.
It may be out the window by now, but I'll do it anyway.
Try it anyway. Let's all give him his free five, okay?
After I speak about the public policies, which I've addressed briefly here, I want to address what I think are the proper interpretations of subs A, B, and C. And then if time permits, I'll discuss traditional policy factors, which the trial court relied on to dismiss the case, too. Some of the historical facts you've already alluded to. Flooding has been a fact of life in Shell Lake for 100 years. The water level has risen. The city has considered several times in the past engineering solutions to the problem. When the water level went down naturally, the city rejected, abandoned those problems for financial reasons. The latest round of flooding was nowhere near the record level of flooding on Shell Lake. It was actually 4 feet below that level. So despite this history, this 100-year history, developers and private property owners have continued to build properties on the lake. And I'm sure that there's some concern among members of the court about, innocent people being injured. And I would just ask you to observe this. Each of the property owners either purchased or built a home in a legally designated floodplain. The presence of a home in a floodplain is considered a defect in property under Wisconsin statutes. It has to be disclosed to a potential buyer. Each of these properties was eligible for flood insurance. We recognize it's expensive. That expense is simply a reflection of the risk involved. We think that it's fair to say that we aren't contending these people did anything illegal, but they wanted to enjoy the lake. They came to the nuisance posed by this flooding voluntarily, and they hoped it would never materialize. The city made the decision in the late 1990s basically to try to rescue their citizens, their property owners around the lake from this flooding. Many of them were already flooded at the time. Others had floodwaters up to their foundations. The project didn't work. Excuse me. The project didn't work, and it was delayed for a year. As you noted, the city was sued by, or the contractors were sued by the city. They settled. with that settlement, the contractors fulfilled their contractual duties to the city. The issue before you is, should the defendants, the contractors, not only be liable to the city for their breach of contract, should they be liable, as the plaintiffs say, to the world at large for every damage, every loss that can be causally connected to their mistake in the project. public policy comes in here. First of all, there is the contract tort distinction. Generally, the breach of a contract is not a tort. It's based on contract law, which says contracting is a good thing. It's actually the fundamental basis of American society and the American economic system. That policy says people ought to be free to contract and they ought to be able to control their risks by contract. And if they didn't agree to accept a risk, then they shouldn't have to bear it.
But if you hurt somebody outside of the contract that has no relationship, what happens then?
Well, the other policy involved is, of course, the tort policy that you refer to. And that serves some different functions. One of the policy is to protect the public from unexpected losses and by compensating victims and by discouraging dangerous conduct.
Mr. Rice, is your outline going to get to the economic loss doctrine and why it is or is not applicable here?
I don't intend to address the economic loss doctrine. It hasn't been raised in this case. There is some similarity between the economic loss doctrine, though, and Section 324A, in that both of them stake out the parameters of when a contractual breach can result in a tort.
But 324A requires physical damage. So if you have property damage or personal injury, you might get under 324A. Economic loss doctrine doesn't cover damage to property or person.
That's correct. And economic loss doctrine is, as I've read this court's recent cases, generally is a doctrine applied between the parties to the contract rather than third parties.
Although there doesn't have to be privity.
I'm sorry?
There doesn't have to be privity to utilize that doctrine. I'm just curious as to why you didn't use it, and apparently you felt it wasn't applicable and 324A was the better approach.
Is that correct? That's correct.
Counsel, in fact, footnote 8 of the Court of Appeals opinion indicates that there's no dispute between the parties that this is an action that is a tort action. Is that your position?
That is my position, yes. The general rule that there's no liability in tort for contract breaches obviously has its limits based on tort law. And generally the limits are that where a breach of contract endangers public safety, whether or not there had been a contract, the victim should be compensated and the conduct should be discouraged. It's not always easy to distinguish a perfectly private wrong from a contractual wrong from a tort. But the settled rule is, I think it's settled in Wisconsin, that there will be liability in tort where there would have been liability had the contractor's action been gratuitous. And I think that is where Section 324A comes into the picture, because that deals with the question of when does a volunteer, a gratuitous actor or a contractor become liable in tort for the negligent performance of an effort to rescue or protect someone else or their property. And 324A actually codifies national case law on just the circumstances and the policies in which courts have said that the policies of encouraging the protection of other people override the policy of compensating tort victims. And generally the mistake is, or line is drawn, I think, on this basis. If the mistakes cause damage that would have occurred anyway if the contractor had done nothing, then there should be no liability. If the mistakes cause damage that would not have occurred but for the actions of the contractor, then there should be liability. 324A has provided a framework that this Court has used on a number of occasions, which structures and informs this Court's decision-making on these very questions of when does the breach of a contract by someone who has contracted to protect other people and their property become a tort.
Our opposing counsel says it's never been used in a case like this. He talked about the Stevenson case, for example, which is a different fact. Do you agree or disagree with that?
The Stevenson case is a volunteer case, as you know.
He says this is unique for this Court to be using 324A.
I don't think it's unique for this Court to be using 324A. In fact, this is exactly the type of situation that 324A deals with.
Is it unique for this Court to use 324A to limit liability that would otherwise exist under common law?
Well,
that's what he's saying. It's unique. Not court. I mean, it's been used in Stevenson. It's been used in Bobby. It's been used in Ritzner. It's been used in a number of cases. He is arguing that it's used uniquely in this case to limit liabilities.
Whether it limits liability or expands liability depends on which direction you're coming from. If you come from the direction of contract law, which says that breaches of contract are not torts, then it actually expands liability because it says these breaches of contracts can be torts. If you come at it from the tort perspective, then it's the opposite. It limits liability.
Was it used to limit liability in Gritzner?
In Gritzner, coming from the tort perspective, I don't think Gritzner involved the contractual undertaking, and coming from the tort's perspective, it wasn't used to limit liability. The Court simply found that there was liability. It was a volunteer undertaking. The Court said that there was liability, that the subsections A, B, and C were met. If they are met, then there is liability. If they hadn't been met, I assume it would have limited liability.
But clearly, this isn't a volunteer. This is the money-making, where the contractor, as noted, they wanted to make some money on this. But you seem to say that because 324 says volunteer or for consideration, that's why you fall under it. So it's not a Good Samaritan, although it's called the Good Samaritan statute or Good Samaritan clause that 324A is known as.
I haven't used the term Good Samaritan here. I know it's part of the section. The reason that contractors fall within this is the policy of contract law, which says that your liability when you undertake something should be limited to what you agreed to. And the reason contractors are included is generally third parties can't sue a contractor for breach of contract unless certain circumstances are met, and they aren't met here.
So these are not third party beneficiaries.
The third party beneficiary doctrine was not pled, but it wouldn't apply here even if it were, because I think under this Court's rulings, this is a public contract. And public contracts don't create a private right of action except under some specific circumstances, and that is if the contract says that it creates liability, and it doesn't here, and if the city would have been liable anyway, had it not contracted out, and that's not met here either. So
the city would not have been liable here for flooding.
The city would not have been liable. It didn't cause this flooding. I think it's been conceded by everyone that the city had no legal responsibility to do anything. As the trial court said, the city had the right to do nothing.
Well, can I ask, there was this order from the DNR that and I'm trying to think which one it was, but I believe it was in 94, that they said in the order, perhaps this is just with the DNR, they said that there was going to be remediation taken to lower the water level. So wasn't that a undertaking of an obligation?
It was not an order, first of all. There was a reference in, there was a reference to an agreement between the city and the DNR. There was never any order issued that compelled the city to do anything. The Court of Appeals said even if there was an agreement between the city and the DNR, that didn't create a duty to the defendants to lower that lake level, and or the plaintiffs to lower that lake level. I go back to the fact that the city didn't cause this, didn't make it any worse, and I believe they had no obligation.
Counselor, opposing counsel was asked about subsection C of 324A and the reliance issue. The Court of Appeals, when they looked at that, said the plaintiffs didn't provide any evidence that they would have done something different if the city hadn't agreed to this contract. But when opposing counsel was asked about that, he said, well, of course the city relied because they chose this contractor. Would you respond to the subsection C concern,
sure,
please?
Sure. Let me say this about subsection C. As you know, it allows recovery where a plaintiff or the other contracting party relied to their detriment on the defendant's conduct. The reliance is a term that's been interpreted by this Court. It was interpreted in Miller versus Bristol-Myers as reliance means that the other contracting party here, the city, either lessened, omitted, neglected, or otherwise altered safety-related practices. As to the plaintiffs, they basically argue if you entered into a contract, then the city relied.
Right.
If that were the case and that were the public policy, then in every contractual undertaking there would be liability, because obviously every party enters into a contract, thinks the other party is going to perform it. Our view is that's not what reliance means. Reliance means that you did something in addition to just entering into the contract. The other party did something, gave up some practice. For example, if the city had a sandbagging policy and they said, well, we got this all taken care of, we've hired you guys, and so we're not going to sandbag anymore, that might be reliance if that caused the damage. Or if the city said, well, we're going to lower the ordinary high water mark because you've taken care of the problem now, then and you could show that you built thinking that that was going, that you were okay, I think that would be reliance. But if you say that just entering into the contract constitutes reliance, then there'll be reliance for every single contractual undertaking.
Counsel, if I could refer you to the Thompson brief at the bottom of page 4, the last two paragraphs, and page 5, reading from the third paragraph in page 4, it's asserted that various alternatives for pipes were considered, including solid wall HDPE high-density pipe rated for 80 pounds per square inch of pressure. The city rejected this alternative as too costly. You go to bottom of page 5, the repair was the slip lining the existing 30-inch pipe with the new 24-inch solid wall PSI pipe, the one that was rejected by the city during the bidding process. I believe it's earlier, it's either on page 5 of that brief or on page 16 of the reply brief of the appellant petitioners that asserts that there were three contracts that were bidded here. So if you have three contracts that were bidding, this alternative was considered, this alternative was rejected by the city, at least inferentially, because they believed that the bid that they accepted would meet the criteria for no leaks, which was part of the planning that was part of this contract system. Why wouldn't that constitute reliance under sub C, which says the harm is suffered because of reliance of the other or the third person upon the undertaking?
The reason is that you have public policies here that you have to use to interpret what reliance means. The public policies are the law of contracts and the policy of encouraging other people to undertake projects like this, whether they do it voluntarily or they do it by contract.
But if you're going to the public policy analysis, that's after seeing whether 324 C applies, sub AC. And I guess my question is, it seems that you're blending the two together to say that C doesn't apply, and it would seem that your public policy argument only kicks in if C applies.
324A subs A, B, and C all incorporate public policy. And if you want to interpret them properly, you have to consider the public policy that underlies them. And if you say that hiring contractor A instead of contractor B constitutes sufficient reliance to create liability under 324A for one of these contractual undertakings to help third parties, then you are saying that every single contract will result in liability, and you are telling contractors that you're not going to encourage them. They can't rely on the risks that are limited by their contract. They're going to be liable in tort for any mistake, even if it would have occurred anyway. And I think it's been pointed out here that if they had done nothing, the damage would have been exactly the same as it is today.
But if the city had gone with the 80-pound slip pipe that ultimately it had to put in, you wouldn't have had the leakage.
That's true. I mean, presumably that's true. It hasn't failed yet. But, if that constitutes reliance, then you have thrown out the policy of encouraging these undertakings. You have thrown out the contract tort distinction. And you have said that in all cases, when you enter into a contract, you're going to be liable to third parties. That's never been the law in Wisconsin up until now. And there are good, solid policy reasons for maintaining that contract tort distinction. As recently as a few years ago, this court has said it should be maintained, and you will be throwing that out with respect to this type of contract if you take that interpretation. And that's why I say that you have to interpret each of these sections in light of public policy.
Did any of the plaintiffs acquire property after the contracts were let?
No.
There's no reliance in that way.
No. With respect to these subsections A, B, and C, I think you appreciate that these are the heart and soul of Section 324A. It's A, B, and C that draw the lines of when a breach of contract is going to be a tort. And generally, as you interpret each of these, I think you have to interpret them in a way that says, that honors the policy, and I think the policy that they state is that if what the contractor did made the situation worse, then there should be liability. If the damage would have happened if the contractor hadn't done anything, then there shouldn't be liability. And if you read sub A, which requires that you increase the risk, that's certainly a situation where you made the matter worse. It's damage that wouldn't have occurred if you hadn't entered into the contract. Sub B, which deals with assuming a duty owed by a third party or owed by the other contracting party to the plaintiffs. If the plaintiffs have a right to sue the city for their losses, a duty owed by them, to the plaintiffs, then the fact that the city contracts it out shouldn't shield either the contractor or the city from liability. They're perfectly consistent with that policy. We think sub C on reliance has to be interpreted consistent with that policy. It really doesn't specify. What do you mean by reliance? Do you mean contractual reliance? They relied on them to by agreement? I think it doesn't mean contractual reliance. If it did, then sub C would render 324A meaningless. I think that it means reliance that has placed the plaintiffs in a position that they are worse off than they would have been if the defendants had done nothing. I think if you, without going into any greater detail about that, I think that if you analyze each section and each argument in light of that principle, which I think is the controlling principle of Section 324A, you will see that all of the interpretations proposed by the plaintiffs would eliminate any kind of liability. They would find liability in every case for contractors. And if you honor the principle that we're only going to hold people liable who are willing to go out and undertake these projects, if they made the situation worse, then you will find that there is no evidence here that the defendants made the situation any worse for the plaintiffs.
Well, they give the example in the restatement of a railroad employee. Maybe I'm not giving you the right example, but I think there's an example in the restatement where an employee fails to do something, but the accident would have happened anyway, but that you'd hold the employee and the company liable because they have a duty to the injured party.
I'm trying to remember that example. I think that it relates to a crossing guard being placed by the railroad, and somebody drives up and the guard waves them through, and they get hit by the train. And
I think that's the one. It's fine.
That increased the risk.
Right.
Presumably, in each case where you make a hypothetical, you can change the facts a little bit so you have liability or you don't. But in a case where a railroad employee waves somebody through and they get hurt, you would think that that a person, but for the presence of that employee there, would have stopped and looked and seen the train coming. So that definitely would increase the risk. You can change facts in any hypothetical to make it a closer and a closer case. But I think the ultimate question is, did the contractors make it worse, or did they really suffer the same damages they would have suffered if the city had done nothing?
Well, then you get this one. The telephone company employs B to inspect its poles. B negligently inspects and approves a pole. Because of the pole's defective condition, the pole falls and injures a traveler. And there, B, who's the employee, is liable to the traveler. So B didn't make it worse because it would have fallen anyway. That's the lake would have risen anyway. But that the fact that he didn't do his job well, it was negligent in inspection, this says you're liable. I have a feeling that the difference in the case, but I'm not sure, is that the telephone company has an obligation to that traveler, and your argument is the city does not.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. At least I understand your argument,
I think. That's right. And when you look at the cases that have been decided by this court that apply 324A, there are a number of them that don't really interpret the subsections. They don't address them. But if you address them yourself, usually they involve cases where the volunteer or the contractor has undertaken a duty which, for example, the employer owed to the employees in the Bristol-Myers case, which the city owned by statute in the coffee case, or which the employer owed to its employees in the American Mutual case. So they don't actually interpret those sections, but I think they're very easy to reconcile with them, with proper interpretation of 324A.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Your red light's on.
You're welcome, Your Honor.
Mr. Beeger?
I'd like to make just a couple points in response. As I understand defendant's argument now, it is that they acknowledge that there is a duty here, but that you look at the subsections under 324A to see if there is a public policy to relieve them from liability. You still get the same conflict that you have whether you call it public policy or you call it duty. Those subsections do not comport with the public policy analysis this Court has taken in Alvarado and other cases. And you could, under defendant's idea, come up with a situation where all of the public policies enumerated in Alvarado or Bowen would indicate that liability should exist in this case, but there isn't liability in 324A.
Isn't the argument in Alvarado and Bowen that there was, the harm was caused? Here, because something was done, here the argument, at least you can help me with this, is that if we hadn't acted, it would have been the same. In other words, the lake was rising. There's a history. We all have read the briefs. But the lake would have come up the 10 inches. And had the project been delayed, it would have come up 10 inches. But the project didn't work, it would have come up 10. It was there before. We did nothing to change it.
I think there are two responses to that, two ways of looking at it. What the Court should look at is not what the difference is between what happened and if nothing had happened. The city could have chosen to do nothing. A city
would not be liable. Duty to reduce the level of the lake.
I don't think so.
Okay.
The city could have chosen in a situation not to build, to fund an ambulance service. But having chosen to build a flood protection scheme, having chosen to fund an ambulance service, once they elect to take an action, they have a duty to do it non-negligently. So, yeah, the city could have done nothing, but could the city have negligently constructed a diversion project? I don't think so. There are issues of immunity and things that we don't have to get into. They could do nothing, but they can't act negligently, having elected to do something.
But what's your damage? The city is negligent in putting in the pipes. They say, hey, trust us, we're going to lower the level of Shell Lake. The pipes don't work. They don't lower the level. Same flooding. What's the damage? You're still in the same scene.
The comparison that must be made is to the plaintiff's situation had the defendants acted non-negligently and the plaintiff's situation given that they acted negligently.
Okay.
And the fact that they acted negligently caused harm, because if they had acted non-negligently, these things would not have happened, at least on this record, for purposes of summary judgment.
Counsel, but if I buy that argument, then sub A fits for every single case you could ever bring up, because you start out assuming that they're negligent, and you're looking at the factors on whether or not there's going to be liability. But if I buy your argument and I use the test you put out, you start them out assuming they should have done a proper job that was not negligent, and you increase the risk because they were negligent. Well, we already assumed in the first part of it they were negligent. I don't see how that fits, because I think it fits every single case you could ever bring up.
I don't think it fits every single case, because I think that you can come up with a situation where even had, and again, I'm trying to come up with a hypothetical standing here and sort of grasping,
right.
But I think there are situations that you can find where somebody acted negligently. They acted in a manner that had the potential of causing damage, but that you can't make that call. causal link and that you essentially beat it under causation under a traditional Wisconsin analysis. And I'm sorry, I can't do better.
That's okay. It's hard, I know. One last thing
that I want to talk about is, what is the rule that they are asking you to apply here? This isn't any case that's published. There's got to be a better rule than, we don't like the facts of this case and we don't think there's liability. Are government contractors in all situations to be immunized? I don't think anyone's arguing that. In the briefs, there's indication it has something to do with the size, that if there's a certain number of plaintiffs or a certain amount of monetary damage, that this is an unreasonable burden. That doesn't seem reasonable either, and that's not something that can be decided on the facts of this case. Is it the purpose that if they're undertaking action to protect third party, then they're immunized? Well, why is that the case is whether they're doing something like building low-income housing or building roads or taking other useful functions. Why are they immunized when they're helping protect third parties? It may be different if a company sends its employees down to help sandbag gratuitously in La Crosse when the river's flooding. But when you have a government contractor being paid good money to take an action, and they do so negligently, and they directly harm third parties, they should be liable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bigot. Thank you, Mr. Bigot, and thank you, Mr. Rice, for your excellent arguments today on our continuing saga of defining what liability is under negligence cases. End our hearing on 04AP1991, Butler v. Advanced Drainage Systems, Inc. et al. We will take a few moments in recess so that the students who wish to leave may do so and additional students may come into the courtroom. We are in recess.